rises, I think of him and I cry. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he tried to tell me so, but I didn't wanna. Summer. He warned me that a wandering man was born to wander. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. And he tried to tell me so, but I didn't want.
Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-9636 remains our telephone number for emergencies only. If you are a regular listener to this show, you may be slightly disappointed tonight. I hope you will not be, and I hope you will stay with me for the next 2 hours. On the Town with Mikey D will be here at 9 o'clock, as it always is. But tonight will not be an ordinary show, because today is not an ordinary day. If you've been near a TV set, radio, newspaper, news site, or social media, you've seen the annual remembrances of one of the darkest moments in modern human history. Here at WMFO, my colleagues have shared their thoughts, their memories, and their emotions, and they've done a commendable job of it all day long. By this point, on September 11th, 2001, the families that would again be together were together, gathered in front of televisions, staring with disbelieving eyes at the endless loop of videos showing the second plane hitting the World Trade Center and the two towers crumbling into clouds of dust that enveloped Lower Manhattan. The time for reflection had not yet begun. We awaited the first words of our president, George W. Bush, hoping that we might have some answers about who had done this, why they had done this, how many lives had been lost, and how we would respond. 18 years later, we are still waiting for those answers. Something unprecedented will happen in the coming weeks in America. For the first time in our recent history, people born after the events of September 11th will be able to vote. They will be joined by college students and high school graduates who have no memory of the day itself, but but who came of age in the America that followed. Who are they? How will they vote? What do they believe about the world and about our country? Those of us who remember 9/11 should be asking the same questions and asking them honestly, because the answer may be both surprising and uncomfortable. For the past 18 years, I have made a point of watching the coverage of 9/11 in the days leading to the anniversary, first on my own videotapes, more recently on YouTube. Like all of you who remember that day, I am still looking for the answers. This year, I found some. They may not be answers you like or want to hear, and I will warn you later in this program before I dig into them. Before that, however, I want to help you understand what I have learned. To do that, I will not discuss September 11th tonight. Instead, I will discuss September 10th and September 12th, the world that was and the world that followed. To set the stage for that day, here is one of the top hits from 2001 that you reasonably could have expected to hear if you tuned in to WMFO Medford. It's a song that is still on my playlist. It's a song that I still dig out every now and again, and it's a song that certainly would have found its way into the big picture had the big picture been on WMFO 18 years ago today.
Desperate for changing, starving for truth. I'm closer to where I started. I'm chasing after you. I'm falling even more in love with you. Letting go of all I've ever longed to. I'm standing here until you make me move. I'm hanging by a moment here with you. Forgetting. You take
September 10th was a Monday, and here in the Northeast, the first day back. The first Monday with kids in school, people at work, and summer vacation memories fading in the face of a cool northern wind. Week one of the 2001 NFL season had wrapped up. The New England Patriots, led by Drew Bledsoe and Adam Vinatieri, lost to the Cincinnati Bengals 23-17 as Tom Brady sat on the sidelines holding a clipboard. In New York City, the Boston Red Sox fell 7-2 to the Yankees. Home runs from Manny Ramirez and Troy O'Leary failing to match an outburst of hits from David Justice, Tino Martinez, and Bernie Williams, among others. Andy Pettit got the win. Hideo Nomo got the loss. I was returning to work in a somber mood after a three-day weekend. The previous Friday, we had buried my brother-in-law's mother, Mary, who had lost her battle with cancer. That morning began with a full and emotional Catholic mass, followed by interment at one of the area's most popular cemeteries, followed by the traditional lunch, a mix of sadness, and the four small talk distractions offered by people who know and care for each other, but don't see each other as often as they should. Most people had spent the weekend seeing a movie. The Musketeer was the top film at the box office, beating out romantic comedy Two Can Play That Game and pushing the previous week's number one, horror film Jeepers Creepers, into third place. Shrek and Jurassic Park 3 were still holding over from the summer. Many of those who went to the movies would have seen this trailer for a film opening in just 2 weeks.
Let me first say, we do not tolerate attacks on our citizens.
Hi, Daddy.
What's the body count?
24 injured, 9 dead. Colombian officials, American intelligence. A nurse and her little boy. That's the father over there.
I talked to him. I told him I was picking up my son.
The wolf has been linked to more than a dozen bombings in the last decade.
I will not tell that grieving father we let his family's killer get away because of protocol.
We can't allow the work of an anonymous criminal to unravel the partnership we've forged with the Colombian government.
Justice for your wife and son isn't a priority right now.
You're not going after him, are you?
Let's say you did manage to get into the country without getting killed. You'll never make it into the guerrilla zone.
The wolf is back in Colombia, but you cannot take the law into your own hands.
We know he's here. The guerrillas, damn sure know he's here. Only two ways he can go, and we control both.
That idiot is trying to commit suicide.
No!
You saved my son.
And your husband killed mine.
Don't even look at those guys unless you can kill them.
He's a man consumed by hate. Just like you.
I'm not like him.
Not yet.
Claudio's gone to Washington to plant another bomb.
Help me stop him.
Surveillance just sent this down. It was taken off one of the Union Station monitors 13 minutes ago.
That's him.
Oh my God.
That film, Collateral Damage, would not be released as planned on September 21st. It would, in fact, be delayed until 2002 and would die at the box office. At that time in my life, I was a senior editor for Harcourt Brace, working on their corporate website at harcourt.com. Each morning, I made my way from my apartment in Lower Alston to an office building across from the Burlington Mall, avoiding traffic through a deep knowledge of side streets and back roads. It was, in every regard, an unremarkable day. Memories of the funeral occupied my thoughts, as did the Tuesday release of two Dario Argento movies I had on order at Sound and Vision in Waltham. After work, it was a drive home with a stop at the liquor store for Monday Night Football beer. The evening news dealt with topics that would not be unfamiliar on September 10th, 2019. Here's a bit of what America's most popular newscast in 2001, had to say.
Can be boiled down to two words, taxes and spending.
And virtually all the tax and spending proposals under discussion are both politically and economically controversial. Politicians may be worried that the surplus is evaporating, but some economists say this is no time to worry about the government going into debt.
It's well established among economists that when the economy is growing slowly, as it is today, or when you're in a recession, deficit spending is exactly the medicine needed in order to give the economy the boost it needs.
Supporters of deficit spending by the government, whether it's on schools or highways or new telecom networks, say it creates good jobs at good wages and enables consumers to keep spending. Others say it's the private sector that has to grow for the economy to revive, and the best way to get it going is to cut the capital gains tax, the tax businesses and individuals pay on investment profits.
The capital gains tax, if it's reduced, that will encourage individuals to put more money into business, especially into the high-tech businesses that have borne the brunt of this economic slowdown.
Republicans favor a cut in the capital gains tax.
It will clearly cause a growth in the economy. It always does.
They're also discussing a cut in the payroll tax that companies and workers pay to fund Social Security. But even supporters of this idea say it's political hemlock.
If you reduce the Social Security payroll tax, you have less money flowing into the Social Security system. And we all know that politicians have made the Social Security Trust Fund sort of a nirvana, that we can't touch that trust fund.
Aside from the contentiousness of these ideas, another problem is timing. The economy needs help now, and the political process is often too slow to deliver relief in a timely way. Some say the only real game in town is the Federal Reserve, which has the option to keep lowering interest rates and is expected to do that next month.
One more time. Many thanks, Betsy Stark. And a word from the public on the subject. An ABC News Washington Post poll finds that most Americans favor reducing the size of President Bush's tax cut as a way to deal with the shrinking federal surplus. 57% of Americans favor cutting the tax cut, and 52% of Americans hold Mr. Bush more responsible than Democrats in the Congress for the smaller surplus. In the national briefing tonight, first, a related item. The Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, has declared war on bureaucracy. That's been done before, of course. Mr. Rumsfeld wants to do something about the billions of dollars he says are wasted on everything from keeping unneeded military bases open to tasks such as garbage collection in the military, which he believed could be sent to private contractors. In Sacramento today, the city's second major manhunt in 3 weeks has ended. A young man killed himself after being cornered by police. He was wanted in connection with 5 murders, and he had videotaped himself ranting at the world, which was a clue. And the Census Bureau says men are finally closing the population gap with women, if only slightly. There were 96 men for every 100 women last year. 20 years ago, there were 94.5 men for every 100 women. More men are actually immigrating to the United States, and fewer men are dying early. The overseas briefing tonight begins with word of a possible assassination in Afghanistan. General Ahmad Massoud commanded the last real military opposition to the Taliban regime. U.S. officials say Massoud has been killed by a suicide bomber disguised as a television cameraman. ABC's John McCarthy reports from the Pentagon. This is a loss for the U.S. General Massoud helped the U.S. gather intelligence on the Taliban and also on the accused terrorist Osama bin Laden, who they believe to be in Afghanistan. The organization Save the Children reports newborn deaths have fallen 14% in the past decade, thanks in part to improved vaccination programs. 4 million babies still die every year, mainly in the poorer countries before they're a month old.
It is interesting to note, all of these years later, that there is no heated rhetoric talking about tax cuts, and that the phrase political hemlock was considered strong language for ABC News back in 2001. The night of September 10th, for me, ended with Monday Night Football, as most Monday nights did, at its old start time of 9:30 in New York City. The Giants lost their season opener to the Denver Broncos 31-20. After the game, I went to sleep. Less than half a mile away, at a Days Inn that I drove past nearly every day, Ahmad Al-Ghamdi and Hans Al-Ghamdi were sleeping. The next morning, as I slept, They woke and headed to Logan Airport to board United Flight 175. This is WMFO Medford.
You're not wired to have a response to this sound. You're neutral to it. You hear it every time you finish a meal and never feel anything. But if we were able to associate this sound with a new stimulus, save the food, we've achieved pulling a natural response from you. Save the food. Why are we doing this, you may ask? Save the food. Because this ad is trying to change your after-meal behavior through brainwashing. Because food waste costs the average family $1,500 a year. Save the food. Cha-ching. And $1,500 extra is like getting a pay raise. Save the food. Cha-ching.
You're promoted.
Which could pay for your child's braces. Save the food.
Cha-ching. You're promoted.
Check out my braces.
So when you hear this sound, rethink your behavior. Cook it, store it, share it. Just don't waste it. For tips and recipes, visit SaveTheFood.com. Brought to you by NRDC and the Ad Council.
So far tonight, I have set the stage by taking us back in time to September 10th, 2001. A Republican president is grappling with an impending recession and trying to figure out how to stimulate the economy. Sports is going on, life is going on, and at the movies, one of the most anticipated films of the fall is a new Arnold Schwarzenegger film where he fights terrorists who blow up his family. Then, the unthinkable. And by September 12th, one day later, answers began to be found. answers had trickled in throughout the day on September 11th, but for the most part, America sat in silence and stared at the television, watching those images over and over again. On September 12th, we woke up to new news. Mohammed Atta had been identified as one of the hijackers, and the federal government announced that they had identified all 12 of the hijackers. After a quiet and confused day back at work, with most people distracted and looking for information on loved ones, I returned home and returned to the news, hoping for more answers. ABC was 25 minutes into their broadcast when Connie Chung went off script and described an airline settlement program instead of the events of Flight 93. It's pretty obvious to see when she goes off script because she pulls the earpiece that her producer would use to talk to her out of her ear and proceeds to deliver some information that was standard procedure and generally well known in the industry, as if this was somehow important or at least more important than what happened on Flight 93. History has proven Connie Chung wrong, and this sets the stage for an unusually emotional response from Peter Jennings, who, like most in the media, was carrying on and doing his job despite little to no sleep. We'll come in with Peter's reaction to Connie Chung.
Airlines and American Airlines, Connie points out at the beginning that it's standard operating procedure for airlines at the moment. And no further comment on it at the moment. You can feel a measure of irritation in the air. There's no question about that, at the very least. But yesterday's attacks have generated an enormous and visceral anger at a lot of things around the country. Most of all, that the United States was vulnerable and that these terrorists managed to reach their objective. Here's ABC's Dean Reynolds in Chicago.
Judging from conversations across the country today, many people are angry and unwilling to wait long for an American retaliation.
Revenge. I want to get even.
This woman near Miami spoke for many.
Send out the F-15s, the F-16s, and go after them.
From St. Louis.
I think we should bomb them back. I really do.
Where the Gateway Arch reopened, came a call for action.
The people should be angry that these terrorists are protected by other countries around the world.
It will be hard to pinpoint a culprit, but many Americans, like this immigrant from Lebanon, said that was no excuse for delay.
They know who's behind all this. They know what country is supporting all these people. They give them money, they give them weapons, they give them everything.
A stranded flyer in Wichita was not interested in a measured response.
They need to find out whoever did this, and they need to clean their clock. I mean, into the Stone Age. This is ridiculous. This does not happen in the United States.
In Columbus, Ohio, it was all about stature.
They can't push us around like this. We're the number one nation, and let's do something about it.
And in Los Angeles, a woman said anything short of a violent response would be useless.
No, I don't feel vengeance, but I think the enemy's got to be eradicated. And you cannot talk with the enemy. You can't rationalize when all they want to do is kill.
For commuters in Chicago, there was no stomach for restraint.
I feel that if we need to have a full-scale war, then we should go ahead and do it. We should at least let them know that the United States isn't going to tolerate this.
I think these people, whoever did it, and I have no idea who did it, are a bunch of cowards. And I would love to face them face-to-face and tell them that they're a bunch of cowards.
A Palestinian worshiper at a downtown mosque supported the president.
President Bush should go after who's doing this and who's harboring them.
But as she dropped her young children off at school this morning, one mother touched on the difficulty a tough response would face.
Can we take out one or two people and be done with it? I'm not sure. I don't think so. I think it's a cultural thing. And you can't eradicate an entire culture.
Elected officials across the country continue to call for calm, and some, including Illinois Governor George Ryan, are warning people not to take matters into their own hands. Ryan issued that warning in light of reports that several mosques in this area have received threatening phone calls. Dean Reynolds, ABC News, Chicago.
The responses from around the country in that ABC News report are interesting. In particular, the final response from the woman who says, "We can't just take out one or two people. We have to destroy an entire culture, and that's something that we cannot do." That was the first sign that there might be some division among the unity. Because for the most part, September 12th was a day of quiet reflection, quiet discussion, quiet reconnection. And that would extend in the days that followed. At the box office and the cinema, Training Day would be pushed back to an October 5th opening from a September 21st opening, where it would start to earn $76.6 million in the United States and enable Denzel Washington to earn a Best Actor Oscar. Collateral Damage, as I noted, was delayed until 2002 and died at the box office. At the time, many people felt that Training Day had become such a huge hit because of America's anger, because we wanted to see the bad guys. Well, we wanted to see the police do something. We needed a place to channel our anger. And Denzel Washington's bad boy cop seemed to be just what we wanted. No films opened the weekend after 9/11. There was no football. Baseball took the week off. The stock exchange, which never opened on September 11th, remained closed until the following Monday, September 17th. By the end of that week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 14% of its value. 684 points were lost on the first day of trading, the largest single-day loss in the market's history. Those losses basically confirmed and paved the way for the recession that the American people had feared. Elsewhere, The Last Castle, a film starring Robert Redford about a crisis at a military prison, caused concern because it showed an upside-down United States flag on its billboard and its marketing materials. This is a traditional symbol of distress in the military, but was not appreciated by the American people in the aftermath of 9/11. The Los Angeles Times reported that press kits for the film came with the following warning. Quote, "Please note that the CDs and CD covers which depict our teaser campaign for The Last Castle were printed prior to the tragic events of September 11th. We apologize for any concern this may cause." The Los Angeles Times spoke to director Rod Lurie, who said, "On the morning of the 11th, after the terrorist attacks, all of us got together and decided collectively as filmmakers, not for marketing reasons, but personal convictions, that not one of us wanted to see the upside-down flag anymore. If we had an American flag, we wanted to fly it right side up." Teaser posters for the summer 2002 release of Sam Raimi's Spider-Man were pulled from distribution and became an instant collector's item. The poster showed Spider-Man hanging from a building near the Empire State Building, with the Twin Towers reflected in the lens on his mask over his left eye. A teaser trailer containing no film footage that showed Spider-Man capturing a helicopter on a spiderweb strung between the Twin Towers was pulled from theaters. No civilian aircraft would fly until September 13th. Home Alone 2 would run on television without its World Trade Center scene for the next 17 years. America was reeling, but America was also moving forward, carrying itself on as best it could. There were no major national events. There was a memorial service for the Pentagon. There was a memorial service for the World Trade Center. There were speeches from the president, speeches from elected leaders. The Department of Homeland Security was created. But there was no forum for people from coast to coast to share their feelings, other than their friends and family. There was no place to go to talk about what had happened outside of professional help or your immediate social network. So we did, as we always do. We carried on, moved on with our lives, went back to business, and hoped that over time, the wounds would heal. There is some evidence to suggest that they haven't. And I will turn to a recent event to illustrate this. Last week, I spoke about the Straight Pride Parade that took place a couple of weekends ago here in Boston, where a group of people just dressed up as clowns and dressed up in goofy outfits, decided to walk around City Hall Plaza and say that they love that they're straight. They were met with protesters. And of the 36 people arrested 2 weekends ago at the Straight Pride Parade, 27 were under the age of 31, making them 13 years old or younger on September 11th. A quarter of those arrested were between 23 and 27, old enough to have potentially understood what happened that dark September day. Some psychologists will tell you that the ages from 5 to 10 are when an individual's personality is formed, and that trauma during these years can carry lifelong consequences. In listening to the anger expressed on September 11th and September 12th, the question remains, what has been done? How have we healed? The phrase "return to normalcy" entered the American lexicon in the days that followed 9/11. It came from the media, elected leaders, and the mouths of Americans looking for some sign that life might return to what it had been on September 10th. Individually, we looked for signs that things would again be normal. An inappropriate joke, an argument over sports, news coverage of someone doing something foolish for attention. As the living do in the aftermath of death, we dragged ourselves back into the familiarity of routine. We went back to work, back to school, back to business. But we did so with a wary eye, still wondering how these attacks could have happened. Those answers are no clearer today than they were 18 years ago. We can say, definitively, that Osama bin Laden ordered the attacks. We can say, definitively, that Mohammed Atta and 11 other hijackers carried out the attacks. We can list our dead. We can watch the video of the buildings falling. We can visit the memorial site in New York, or in Pentagon, or in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But what we still cannot explain, 18 years later, is how our government failed so spectacularly, or why Osama bin Laden and those terrorists felt the need to carry out these sorts of attacks against the United States. Those are the questions we failed to answer. Those are the questions that still haunt us, along with the images of that day, and the pain and fear and grief that has lingered. It can be said that we woke up on September 12th, 2001, and have woken up to that same day ever since. Those of us who recall September 12th are still haunted by it. Those who were born since September 11th have been the prisoners of our collective fear, anger, and sadness. Airport scanners have not relieved that fear. Metal detectors at theaters and sports stadiums offer inconvenience rather than comfort. The National Guard no longer patrols most of our big events, but we know that surveillance is everywhere, and we suspect sharpshooters and police are not far behind. We have instilled an existential fear in many, but not all, of our young people. And I will turn back to those arrest records from the Straight Pride Parade, where, as I pointed out, 27 of those arrested were under the age of 31. A quarter of them were between the age of 23 and 27. These are important numbers. These are important ages. There are answers that are starting to be found. We have instilled an existential fear in our young, and we see this reflected in the extremity of their views and their active anger toward those who disagree with them. Not all young people act this way. Not all young people have extreme views. But enough of them in this country do that we have to recognize that there is some level of a generational crisis taking place. This is not the first time in my lifetime that anger has infected many of our youth. It happened during the Vietnam War when a generation rose up against the possibility of death on a foreign battlefield. That anger passed, as those who remember the 1980s and late 1970s will tell you. It passed because America took steps to confront it directly, as well as the circumstances behind the anger. The war came to an end, but the United States also lowered the voting age to 18 and abolished peacetime draft registration for nearly a decade. Those decisions did not compensate for the lives lost in Vietnam, but they addressed the underlying causes of the anger, and they offered some reassurance that this situation would not happen again. At the very least, those young Americans that we ask to make the supreme sacrifice in some cases would have the ability to vote, and some say, over the leadership of their country. It's not happening. 2001, or in the years since. No permanent change has come following September 11th beyond bureaucracy and security. The death of Osama bin Laden in 2011 provided a moment of catharsis, but did not end our involvement in Afghanistan, where the war now drags into its 18th year. More dangerous enemies stepped in to fill the gap that Osama bin Laden left. This gave rise to ISIS and laid waste to Syria, Libya, and much of Iraq. It sparked an immigration crisis that has roiled European politics, brought about the rise of extreme far-right and extreme far-left groups, neo-Nazism in Germany, border closings in parts of Europe, and a general anti-immigrant attitude. Our government here in the United States can fairly claim that there have been no massive terrorist attacks since 2001. This is true, but such a claim ignores the fact that the damage has already been done. No more massive attacks are needed. Small attacks, be it a shooting at a Christmas party in California or a man in a rental truck killing pedestrians along New York's West Side Highway, are enough to reopen the wound, to remind us that we do not feel safer because nothing concrete has been done to improve our safety. Osama bin Laden's goal on 9/11 was to destroy America from within. His goal was to turn the American people against each other and to turn the people against the government. As we look back 18 years later, and as time begins to lift the fog of daily experience, I can only conclude that Osama bin Laden won. Osama bin Laden won. He won the moment the second plane hit the World Trade Center in full view on national television. He won again when a third plane hit the Pentagon. It was by design for everyone to see, and everyone across the United States and around the world saw it happen. We saw the devastation and destruction in real time. Collectively, whether you knew someone involved or not, we experienced the trauma. The Oxford Clinical Psychology publishes a guide that talks about, it is a psychology textbook, that talks about common reactions to trauma. And I'm going to defend that statement that Osama bin Laden won by citing some of the 10 common reactions to trauma. They are anxiety and fear, increased vigilance, impatience and irritability, avoidance of your actual feelings about something, anger, negative self-image and negative view of the world, and decreased sexual interest. There are some others. Those are the most relevant, and they are everywhere in our society today. They are, in fact, considered common personality traits among many millennials and young people. How did we get there? How does this happen? Most parents will tell you that they did everything that they could to look after their children in the days following 9/11. They shielded their kids from the coverage. They taught their kids that this was not a group of people that hated us, that we did not hate other cultures, that we were safe, that we were in control, that we had security. Looking at the obvious signs of post-traumatic stress syndrome in that generation, it's clear that those efforts failed. And those efforts failed for a simple reason. All the children had to do was look at their parents and see the pain in their parents' eyes and the parents' inability to acknowledge their own grief and confusion over that day and recognize that what they were being told about the world was not the truth. The truth is that you did not need to be in New York, Washington, Los Angeles, San Francisco, or Pennsylvania to be directly affected by the terror attacks. And for those who question Los Angeles and San Francisco, those two forgotten cities were the destinations of the four planes that crashed on September 11th. If you knew someone who died that day, as I do, today is more personal. Today is a day to stop and pause and think about the life that could have been, which is what we all lose when someone close to us dies. For many people, it is simply about the world that could have been. The America, the United States, the North America, the Europe, the Middle East, all of those places that saw one potential future wiped away in a series of terrorist attacks. The truth is that we all suffered a severe trauma on 9/11 by Osama bin Laden's design. We have all seen the planes hit the buildings, the collapses, the smoke, the fire, the faces of terrified New Yorkers, and the exhaustion of first responders who had hoped to save lives but found few who survived. We have not discussed this in a meaningful way as a nation. We put our heads down, we went back to work, and we waited for a return to normalcy that never came. We woke up on September 12, 2001 in shock and confusion. We have been living that day ever since, and we have now raised a generation in the shadow of our fear while offering no real solutions for how to overcome it. At the beginning of tonight's show, I noted that for the first time, people born after 9/11 will vote in upcoming elections. The date is, to them, something from a history book. They cannot comprehend the world that existed on September 10th or September 11th, or believe that our country is anything other than the gloomy, divisive place they have inherited. In spite of this, there may be some cause for hope. This morning, WBZ played interviews with two high school students, asking them what September 11th meant to them. A young woman said it brought out America's bigotry, which is not true, though it is something she has been taught through the anger and despair of those adults trusted to her care. This is one very obvious consequence of 9/11. The days following 9/11, 9/12, 9/13, 9/14 were not filled with bigotry and hate. As you heard from the ABC clip earlier, most Americans understood that our enemy was overseas and protected by a foreign nation. We waited until we knew who those enemies were and where they could be found before we attacked. Were there some Americans who, in a fit of anger, phoned in death threats to mosques? Yes, there were. And you will always find a few people with anger control issues in any situation. They did not speak for America. They did not represent America or America's view. In the days following 9/11, starting on 9/12, we were, for the most part, very united, including Muslims, Christians, Jews, black, white, Asian. Everyone shared in the grief. And this was reflected in what a young man said, speaking to WBZ. He said that it brought America together. There is much more truth in that statement, but it also falls a bit short of reality. The week that followed 9/11 was one of the quietest those of us who were alive at the time can remember. We had time to reflect, but we did not. There was such demand for United States flags that most stores sold out. Flag makers went back to work overtime to meet the demand. Many people who had never flown a United States flag added one to their home. Most of those flags still fly today. There was a grim solidarity that stretched over the next several weeks. It was not a time for laughter or entertainment, but it was a time to huddle with the people you cared for. Old classmates got back in touch. College friends reconnected. Co-workers held impromptu reunions. Old loves reached out to one another. These reconnections all began from the same point with the same questions. Where were you? How are you? Did you know anyone who died? For nearly all of us in the Northeast, the answer to the question, did you know anyone who died, was a quiet yes. Americans returned to their churches following 9/11. Millions gave blood, hoping they might help survivors. The sights and sounds of airplanes triggered concern in ways they never had before. Following that week, the divisions began to take hold. Some wanted nuclear revenge, and we heard that in the ABC clip. Others wanted change in foreign policy. Debates raged over patriotism as some hardened their support of the United States flag and others blamed America and its leaders for the attacks. Conspiracy theories began to take form in the void of answers around us, ensnaring armchair hobbyists as well as professional engineers and scientists. We came to accept that bomb detectors, metal detectors, and extra police presence would be a part of our lives, resisting the urge to fight the limitation of our freedoms. We limited what we said about 9/11 and almost immediately purged our minds of the images of those who fell to their deaths. 9/11 would be about planes and buildings, not about the physical destruction of nearly 3,000 people. A generation has now grown up and come of age against this backdrop. They show all the signs of trauma that those of us who remember the world before also exhibit. For a particular group of millennials, their fear and anger are on continual display. They are the next generation of casualties from September 11th, and further evidence that Osama bin Laden succeeded in his plan to destroy us from within. And I have to stress this. We, as a nation, have not dealt with our feelings about that day. Those of us who are alive, those of us who remember, have yet to face the reality of what was lost and have yet to confront how we feel and what it made us think of the world and the people around us. And because we have failed to react and evaluate and learn, we have left our children to find those answers on their own. And they become fearful. And they become anxious. And the answers that we give them, saying everything will be okay and the world is a good place, are answers that they know we do not necessarily still believe. There are two signs of hope, however. The first happened on September 11th itself. It is not unreasonable to assume that Osama bin Laden deliberately staggered the plane's departure times for two reasons. One, we know he wanted them to be seen on television. He wanted to make sure all the cameras were pointed at the Twin Towers when the second plane hit. But another reason may have been that Osama bin Laden predicted that the United States government would take action against any planes still in the sky once the attacks began. As we know, President Bush authorized Vice President Dick Cheney, who was running the bunker in Washington, to shoot down any civilian aircraft that failed to comply with military orders. This would have killed everyone on board, including civilians, to save people on the ground. Such a strategy may have saved lives, but also would have led to significant outrage against the Bush administration. We are fortunate that this did not happen, because a group of brave Americans took matters into their own hands on board United Flight 93. They remind us, even today, that in the face of certain disaster, there are those among us willing to make the ultimate sacrifice to save others. It was a story that we heard time and time again from the rubble of the Twin Towers in New York City. firefighters who climbed dozens of flights of stairs to try and save lives and put out the flames. A floor captain charged with making sure everyone on his floor got out safely, who stayed behind and did not survive. A man last seen holding the door so that other people could escape. Even in the greatest moments of darkness, we find those beacons of light among our fellow Americans. The other sign of hope appeared last February in Florida. Following the shootings at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, amid the pain, grief, and predictable responses from politicians and special interest groups, came something new. A group of high school students, born after 9/11, who challenged the status quo. They toured the country, sharing their grief and inviting discussion. They appealed for common sense legislative change that still languishes in Washington. They decided to stand up, stand together, and build a coalition of like-minded people, but most importantly, they chose to do something concrete to try and give that day meaning. If this is how those born after 9/11 choose to cope with the world, we may be in very good hands in the future. For now, I find myself in a country I no longer recognize. The anger, personal attacks that flow across the internet, through the media, and in our streets were not a part of my younger years. The New York Post offered some perspective on this from New York in a letter published today. From a column by Michael Goodwin, where he discusses the reaction and the divisiveness in the United States. He quotes a letter at length from Maria Smith, who says this, quote, "I am a native Staten Islander born here before the bridge and lived in Battery Park City for 30 years, from where I witnessed and survived both the 1993 bombings and the 9/11 attack. I chose to stay in Lower Manhattan to rebuild my neighborhood at a time when the real estate value of my home was zero. Half of Battery Park City moved out after 9/11, but I, along with many others, and especially Community Board 1, fought to rebuild our neighborhood. It wasn't easy. We lived with the National Guard for 6 months. Con Ed and Verizon wiring lay on top of the sidewalks for about a year. Many stores closed and never reopened. I write all this on the eve of September 11th because I am looking at my city now and am horrified. The streets are filthy. The cops can't do anything. The homeless situation is beyond tragic. And there is a hostility and violence in the air that I have not felt since I moved to Manhattan 30 years ago. To be honest, walking to work today, I thought to myself, why did I work so hard and choose to fight to stay here? This is what my city has become, a place for people who are not from New York, who are either extremely wealthy or extremely poor. A city where the rules no longer apply. A city where there is once again graffiti. I can't believe it. Yet no one says anything about how bad things are, and it appears as though none of our political leaders have the courage or guts to take on the lack of leadership of this mayor. I write out of frustration, out of concern, out of fear. Like so many others have done, I'm traveling to North Carolina at the end of the month to see what's available in terms of jobs and housing. I never thought I would say that. My family goes back to the 1840s in Brooklyn due to the Irish famine. We are real New Yorkers, and one by one, we are leaving. I'm usually upbeat about my home, my city. But this summer turned out to be a tipping point." As I find myself saying here on WMFO Medford, more often these days, we are the problem. All of us. We are the problem. We resolved on September 12th that the terrorists would not win, but our actions 18 years later show that they have. They continue to win with every act of incivility and willful